Welcome to Pop Pantheon, the podcast where we completely overanalyze all of your favorite pop stars and then rank them in the official Pop Pantheon. This is your host, DJ Louis the 14th, and I want to remind you to please rate, review, and subscribe to the show wherever you're listening to it now. Follow us on social media at Pop Pantheon Pod. I'm at DJ LOUIEXIV on Twitter and Instagram. Our merch is available at poppantheonpod.com and our Patreon channel, Pop Pantheon All Access, where we do bonus episodes of this show every single week is available at patreon.com/poppantheon, or you can subscribe for the audio only in the Apple Podcasts app directly. Gorgeous, gorgeous. My queer pop party is happening tomorrow night in New York. That is May 10th. It is, if not sold out at this point, almost sold out. So grab your tickets while you still can. Also, next weekend, Saturday, May 18th, we will be back at Los Globos in Silver Lake in LA. Tickets for both of those available in the show notes of this episode. All right, so for this week's B-side, we had a couple episodes recently where we were diving into the importance of the classic MTV show Unplugged. I'm thinking of our Mariah Carey series, where she had an iconic moment on Unplugged, and of course, our Nirvana episode a couple weeks ago, where Nirvana had, some argue, their best moment ever on MTV Unplugged, and it got me wondering about Unplugged. And I know there's a lot of people that grew up with Unplugged who listen to the show. I know there's plenty of people that did not experience MTV's heyday and maybe don't understand the context and importance of Unplugged. So in thinking about that, Russ and I recruited Craig Marks and Rob Tenenbaum, who wrote the book I Want My MTV, an incredible tome about the history of the channel, to come on and talk to us about Unplugged, how it happened, what it was, why bands did it, why pop acts did it, why it became popular, why it still resonates today, and some of the most iconic performances that happened on it, from Mariah to Nirvana and so many others. So this was such a delightful conversation, and I hope you guys enjoy this talk about MTV's Unplugged. So I'm here with Rob Tenenbaum and Craig Marks, who are the authors of I Want My MTV, the uncensored story of the music video revolution. Rob, Craig, welcome to the show.
Hi, Louis.
Thanks, Louis.
Big fans of the book. If you haven't read it and you are a fan of this podcast, I highly recommend that you do, because it's a wonderful tome on the story of MTV, which I think for some of our listeners is a nostalgic point. For some of our listeners, they probably have little to no recollection of MTV in its prime at this point. To them, MTV is Teen Mom and like the last vestiges of the VMAs.
Ridiculousness.
But obviously for me, I'm 37, so I grew up in the height of more of like the TRL era of MTV. We've done episodes on TRL. We've done episodes on the VMAs. So this is kind of fitting into that series. And part of the reason that Russ and I came up with this concept was that we've done a couple episodes recently which have touched extensively on MTV Unplugged, one of which was a series we did at the end of last year on Mariah Carey. And the second was an episode that came out a couple of weeks ago about Nirvana. And, you know, I was especially kind of haunted by the Nirvana Unplugged performance, as I think many people are, because it was recorded just prior to Kurt Cobain's death, released just after his death, and it has the specter of that tragedy hanging over it. And I think in many people's minds, it is one of the definitive MTV Unplugged performances. So I wonder if, just to sort of get us into this conversation, speaking to somebody that maybe is in their 20s, never watched MTV Unplugged, really has no idea what it is, can you just explain in broad terms what this show was and maybe why artists did it? Like, what was it serving for artists in the time period where it was popular? What would be the reason for an artist to go on this show?
Well, in the beginning, it was to prove that you were credible. Mm. Unplugged starts to air in the fall of 1989. And it's really the vision of two maniacs. And a lot of things at MTV had similar origin stories where someone advocated for it and was told no and kept advocating over and over. And, you know, then it was a huge success and everyone wanted to claim credit for it, which is definitely part of the story. But 1989 at MTV, their ratings were great. But inside the network, they had a little bit of a programming problem, because a lot of the times they hated what they were playing. Mm. They were playing a lot of hair metal. They had started to play a lot of hip hop, and also hip hop influenced pop music, including Milli Vanilli. You know, I think Craig and I both love that era of music, but it was cheap and it was tawdry, which are two qualities we love about pop music. But not everyone there loved that. So they wanted to do something that got back to the album-oriented rock origins of the network. How do we get more middle-aged white dudes who play guitars and write their own songs back onto the network? So when Bob Small and Jim Burns pitched the idea for Unplugged, over and over again, they were told no. And then finally, like a lot of industrious people at MTV, they found an advocate in Judy McGrath, who said yes to the show. Took a little while to get off the ground, but once it found its footing, it became essential to the brand from 1989 to 1999.
What I'll add to that is that MTV at that time was kind of in an existential crisis in that they realized they couldn't just air music videos one after the other kind of randomly and attract an audience. You know, there's a story in our book where I think someone says you needed to have a TV Guide listing that, you know, back in the day, there was a magazine called TV Guide. People would check it to see what was on the air, believe it or not. And if it just said music video, music videos every half hour, people wouldn't necessarily tune in. There was no appointment viewing. And so they were always looking for long form shows, half hour shows that had a defined, you know, theme, let's say. Some of that was musical, some of that wasn't. Unplugged gave them the chance to call a show, to deliver this music show that still had a, if not a narrative, at least it had a theme and a structure. And then also it enabled them to break individual videos out of that show and put those into rotation. So they got a lot of content, as we say, from one half hour or then hour long episode of Unplugged. The other thing that Unplugged did was counteracted the notion that the critics had of MTV and of music videos, that they were fake, that this was not real music, that it was all flash and style and there's no substance. As Rob mentioned earlier, while we're great fans of flash and all that, there needed to be some balance against that, both internally from people like Judy McGrath, an executive there, and from the music industry as well, and from viewers. They were starting to weary, I think, of hair metal videos that, you know, with explosions and pyro and girls on top of cars and things. And there needed to be some balance to that. And so Unplugged, the notion of authenticity, which is, I think, a word we'll use a lot today, real musicians playing real music, a little out of their comfort zone, you know, getting back to the quote unquote roots, the opposite of Bob Dylan going electric. This was MTV going acoustic. And so it had good imaging for MTV and proved to be extremely popular rite of passage and a commercial opportunity for the artists who participated.
99% of the time in radio or on television, programming is reverse engineered according to advertising. How do you sell ads on MTV if the company that's buying that ad time doesn't know, is it going to be between a Milli Vanilli ad and a Motley Crue video? That's not a very safe space to be in if you're an advertiser. It's uncertain, it's vague, but if you can buy advertising up against a show where real musicians, I'm using finger quotes, are playing real songs that they really wrote, then that's something that makes advertisers feel safe. Mm.
So in terms of MTV pivoting away from being just blocks and blocks of music videos, is Unplugged the first show they're experimenting with, or is it one of a slew of shows? Like in that late 80s moment beyond Unplugged, is it a whole slate of other ideas that they're trying? Like what is the other shows that are surrounding Unplugged as ways to break this up?
Musically, there was Club MTV,
right?
I believe hosted by Julie Brown to start. I could be wrong about that. There was Remote Control, which was their first foray out of music programming into a sort of satirical game show. Mm. Rob, what else was there around that time?
There was Yo MTV Raps.
Mm. Right.
Right.
Which was the most successful. Yo. And again, is a story where nobody at MTV wanted it. Craig and I spoke to Bob Small and Jim Burns, who created the Unplugged series. And, you know, they said nobody wanted it. And it was the same thing with Yo. There's so many of the programming decisions that MTV thrived on initially met with resistance. which is ironic because when MTV came on the air, none of the cable operators wanted it. None of the advertisers wanted it.
But in fairness to the executives, they were willing to try things. They were willing to throw shit against the wall. They might not support it until it was proven to be financially successful and get an audience, but they were trying everything at a certain point. If you go on Wikipedia and look at all the shows that aired on MTV, there's hundreds of them, literally hundreds of shows that maybe you wouldn't remember. From animated shows that you won't remember to music shows that you won't remember to game shows that you don't remember. So, well, Rob's right. They were reluctant and resistant. They didn't refuse. They were like, okay, here's a small budget. We'll put it on. In the case of Yo! MTV Raps, it was at 3 a.m. or midnight or some ungodly hour. And the proof is in the pudding. If people watch it, we'll do more of it. If people don't, we won't.
So just to situate us again a little bit more broadly before we just dig into the show a little bit more. So when I was in my formative years, let's say 1998 to 2003, four, MTV, it would be hard to understate the centrality to my teenage years and culture. Like, it was the universal gathering space for my generation to experience pop music culture. That had as much to do with just the airing of music videos as it had to do with the fact that TRL was a must-watch thing that you participated in every day. The VMAs were like the site of so many explosive live performances that came to define my pop cultural mind at that time period. How would you characterize in the late 80s MTV's cultural positioning amongst the youth? Obviously, it's a huge deal. The 80s are a massive time for music videos, and MTV is the central place where people are consuming them. But is it equivalent to that late 90s, early 2000s moment in terms of its omnipresence and importance? Is it different? How would you characterize MTV's positioning in the firmament?
Well, I would say first, Rob, just to cut in, we've talked about even artists, you know, Madonna, Michael Jackson, Bon Jovi, Duran Duran, Bruce Springsteen, even artists who today, if they're alive, can fill arenas and or stadiums. That's in large part, even with someone like Bruce Springsteen, due to the fact how monocultural MTV was back in the 1980s in particular, even more so than in the 90s, I think. Because in the 90s, MTV was bigger than it was in the 80s, but the music videos themselves were not. Because by that point, the real world was on the air, and reality television had taken a foothold, a very profitable foothold on MTV.
This is the true story. True story.
Of seven strangers picked to live in a loft
and have their lives taped
to find out what happens.
What?
When people stop being polite.
Could you get the phone?
And start getting real.
And so music videos were sharing the airtime with other programming. In the 1980s, and even when Unplugged aired, MTV was essentially, you know, 90% music videos. And so if you were Billy Idol and you had a series of music videos that got heavy rotation on MTV, or you were REM in the late 80s, you could be assured not just of a financial windfall back then, but you could probably even still to this day make bank off of the impressions that those music videos left back in the 1980s. I don't think it can really even be overstated just how significant MTV was for the music industry, for the artist, and for the culture at large.
So MTV comes on the air in 1981, and that's really the beginning of the cable TV era. Anyone who's listening to this who is young has no recollection. There were three networks, ABC, NBC, CBS. That was what you watched. If you were lucky, you had some local channels. The cable TV era is the start of the atomization of popular culture. However many people watched the last episode of MASH, I think it was 50 million, something like that. The idea of 50 million people watching the same show now would be unheard of. So cable TV starts to break down the monoculture, but for a period of time, MTV was the last vestige of the monoculture. The same way that if you wanted news, there was CNN and there was nothing else. If you wanted to see music on TV and also to hear a variety of music, because by the late 80s, MTV was playing a much wider range of music than they originally had. So if you were a kid, you would race home after school to watch Yo! MTV Raps. But if it didn't come on right away, maybe you'd see a Motley Crue video and discover that you kind of liked Motley Crue. Or you were tuning into Headbangers Ball and shit, here's this new style of music called hip hop that hadn't really hit middle America yet. And you get exposed to that. So it was both the coffee shop where all kids went, and it was also a way of finding out about new music. right? That you weren't going to get on the radio. If you were listening to a rock station, they were never going to play MC Hammer. And if you were listening to a top 40 station, they were never going to play, you know, Metallica. Mm. So because of the breadth of programming, it was a good way for people to discover music outside of the genre that they preferred.
It also bears mentioning, even though it's obvious that, you know, there was no internet.
Right.
The video game industry was nascent. Mm. For teenagers and young people, there weren't any other choices, really. MTV was both cool, believe it or not, and it was this mainstream industry with, you know, by 1987 or 89 had great reach into homes all across America. It's also worth noting that MTV started in the suburbs. You know, it wasn't even available in New York and LA for the first 2 years. So back in 1981 and two, the reasons that America fell in love with the Culture Club and Duran Duran and ABC and these new wave bands is because those were the only music videos that were available for MTV to play. And MTV had their actual cables in far-flung places like Tulsa, Oklahoma. So it immediately had a foothold in the burbs. And so come 1989, it's really the only game in town.
I love the notion of it as a place for genre breakdown amongst its viewers, because when I was in my peak MTV years, it felt like it had narrowed its focus pretty significantly towards pure pop music, some version of hip-hop that had pop fluency. It wasn't so omnivorous in terms of genre, but I feel like in being so in the time period that you're discussing feels like a precursor to a lot of the ways that I think most music consumers think about their taste these days, in the sense that like most people are not so siloed into, I like in my childhood, again, there was such a feeling of there were the skater kids and they liked punk and, you know, there were the hip hop kids and they liked hip hop. And there was a lot of fraught tension around liking pop music or not liking pop music and all of that. So I like the idea of MTV and its earlier phases as a place of setting the agenda that would actually come to bear fruit more fully, like in the contemporary period in the last 15 years, where it feels like people are less beholden to a certain genre of music that then defines their entire personality. And there's a lot of underlying social tension around that.
There was a little bit of that shuffle playlist mentality where you would see REM or hear REM or watch REM next to Mariah Carey, next to Warrant, next to Camper Van Beethoven.
Yeah.
You know, MTV did have its own narrow casting shows. Besides Yo MTV Raps, it had 120 Minutes, it had Headbangers Ball. Mm-hmm. But, you know, those were midnight on Saturday or Thursday at 11. That was not during prime time or drive time. It was much more randomized.
And, and the bulk of MTV's programming was the opposite of the algorithms that we now have. It wasn't saying to you, here's the type of music we think you like, here's other music that sounds just like it, right? If all you wanted was hard rock, you could watch Headbangers Ball, but that was on for only an hour a week. So most of the time you were going to get exposed to music that the algorithm never would have served you.
All right, so let's talk about Unplugged. So we talked a little bit about how the show came into fruition. Can you just explain what happens on this show? In its earliest days, if there are any like specific examples that come to mind for either of you, like how does the show's format take shape? What goes on this show?
The first couple episodes were hosted by a songwriter named Jules Shear, who was a wonderful songwriter and had hit, but was not a magnetic personality. He was the wrong person for the job. And the way the show was set up, it was two different bands. And one band would play some songs. The other band would play some songs. They'd play a song together. It was a little bit neither fish nor fowl. Mm. The first episode had Squeeze and Elliot Easton from The Cars and the songwriter, singer, Sid Straw. Not household names.
But behind the chalet, a holiday's complete.
And it really took them a while to figure out what the format was and how to make it work. And that involved, first of all, not having a host. And then second of all, focusing on one band. At first, a half an hour show and then an hour show. You know, and there are some funny stories that Bob Small and Jim Burns tell about Squeeze showing up, for instance, to an Unplugged show. And they've brought their electric guitars with them. And they have to say to the band, no, it's Unplugged. And then, you know, go out and rent them acoustic guitars for the afternoon. So it was an unusual idea, certainly. So many things, including just the term music video. If you went back to 1980 or 1981 and said music video to someone, they had no idea what you were talking about. The term didn't exist. And the same thing is true for the term unplugged. Mm. You know, you unplugged your TV. Other than that, it's not a word that was in the American vocabulary.
But from the beginning, it's a band and they're playing to a small audience and they're trying to create the intimate feel of like a coffee shop almost kind of vibe, right?
Yeah, there's carpets on the stage. Right. There's drapes kind of hanging down in various places.
Some candles.
There came to be a lot of candles.
That's what I remember, the candles.
Yeah, the set is actually almost as iconic visually as the music was. It really became, you know, like you said, a coffee shop sort of setting with a very close-in audience, a very small invite-only guest list.
The first few audiences were so scarce. No one was coming to see this thing because nobody knew what it was. Right. So the MTV executives would call back to the office and say, hey, we start shooting in half an hour. We only have 40 people here. Gather up everybody who's still in the office and bring them over here.
Mm. So those early episodes are successful ratings-wise or not? Like, is it the kind of thing where it's just like a quiet thing to begin with?
They're not particularly successful. They're just fine. Mm. The fourth show was The Alarm, this Welsh kind of Clash-like rock band, and a group I've never heard of in my life called Nuclear Valdez.
Mm.
We're back. This is MTV Unplugged, and we have with us a couple of guys from Nuclear Valdez.
So it was not easy for them to book talent. Mm. I think things changed when Don Henley, of all people, decided to play a show in the second year of Unplugged.
Mm.
I'm gonna love you like no one's loved you. Come rain or come shine.
And that gave cover for other A-list artists to begin to try their hand at it.
So Don Henley's appearance just in terms of his stature, not in terms of changing the format.
Right. No, he's a big star and he's also a known asshole in the music industry. And if Don Henley consents to do it, then you can't really raise an objection. If Henley will do it, I'll do it kind of thing.
I just want Larry Salters and Irving Azoff to understand that Craig was the one who called Don Henley an asshole. I'm not denying that that's the case. I just didn't say it. And here's how Henley got on Unplugged. And the story kind of speaks for itself. They were able to book Joe Walsh to come on. Walsh performed on Unplugged the Eagles song Desperado, which was written by Henley. And Henley denied MTV the right to air that song. And he sent a 3-page fax to MTV explaining why. Henley is famous for sending angry, angry faxes.
He's a litigious artist.
And again, Craig, not Rob, saying that. And so Henley said, no, Joe Walsh can't do this song. He's not allowed to. So MTV said, well, look, somebody needs to do Desperado the right way. Why don't you come on and do it? And he did.
Clever.
By the way, a little bit of inside baseball. There were some artists Craig and I wanted to interview and couldn't get, you know, people who didn't say no, but it was just a matter of asking over and over again. Henley was one of the ones we wanted. Finally, I said to his representatives, look, if we don't hear from him by Friday, that's the drop dead date, we still really want him. His publicist called me up and said, I just received a fax from Don. And he read me the fax, which was hilarious and profane. And he was so contemptuous of MTV. And I thought, oh my God, this is perfect. Can we use this? No. Why write and send a fax and read it to us if we can't use it? That's just the way Don Henley
God. Was. So you're not the one calling him an asshole, but you are the one illustrating why he is an asshole.
He's probably writing you a fax right now, Louis.
It would be my absolute honor to receive a fax from Don Henley.
You say that now.
Okay, let me find a fax machine I can plug in.
Until you have to get an attorney.
Yeah. So are there episodes early on in the post-Henley moment that become the early definitive Unplugged episodes? Like, what are the ones that begin to assert this show as the sort of cultural force that it becomes?
Well, I'd say one of them is Sinead O'Connor in 1990. She was the first woman to do her own show. Elton John, who said at one point in his performance, this is the show that lip syncers are terrified of.
Right, in the post-Milli Vanilli firmament.
I think Aerosmith too, which kind of set the template for a band, you know, especially when grunge happened, it became the de facto image in my head besides L Cool J of artists doing Unplugged, you know, sitting around in a semicircle, playing drums very softly, or sometimes even playing like a box or a bongos or kind of thing, you know, an acoustic bass. And sort of intentionally reworking your songs to fit the format, not just doing it impromptu or stripped down, but kind of thinking about ahead of time how I can retrofit my songs to fit this format to make it special. You know, looking back, Aerosmith is kind of the first band to really figure out how to make Unplugged work for them.
Right. And it's like a band that's traditionally so loud and sort of colorful, finding a way to feel intimate and reintroduce their songs in an entirely different way. And as you mentioned earlier in the show, show off a different side of their artistry.
And sitting down.
Right.
It's, that's the other important part.
Sitting down. Mm. I keep going back for like the coffee shop, because I feel like the coffee shop was such a 90s thing. Like the idea of someone sitting with their acoustic guitar. And like, I feel like this was kind of like a broad scale version of that. And also kind of serving the same function that Tiny Desk is serving today in our culture.
Yeah. Absolutely. Tiny Desk is clearly the inheritor of what Unplugged wrought.
Right. And it makes a lot of sense, I think, for people that are of this generation to make the connection, because it is delightful to watch someone like Usher or Chappell Roan or whoever you're into these days come in and just completely sort of like rework their music in a way that, again, I do think this sort of concept of authenticity and this idea of musicianship comes into play here. Like, the types of artists that can do this, I don't know if this is necessarily true, but the impression that it feels like it leaves with people is like, oh, if you strip away the bells and whistles of the studio or of the arena show, you have real music here. You have a real artist here who could just sit there and play the guitar for you, which is still, I think, for better and worse, and sometimes really for worse, the rockest ideal of authenticity that we all seem to hold very close to our hearts.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. When I watched the Juvenile Tiny Desk, that was purely L Cool J walked on Unplugged so Juvenile could run, you know, and all the hip hop artists who reworked their sets, their songs to feature backup singers and musicians and, you know, bring in a large cast that is so clearly based on that kind of original text of L Cool J and Tribe Called Quest and De La and MC Light on Unplugged. The other show that I see a lot of common ground with Unplugged is the Grammys. You know, the Grammys love to figure out how to have these kind of once in a lifetime moments, but they're often buttressed by, let's just get this artist in front of a piano, but with a big chorus behind them and a string section, and let's break down their music and then kind of build it up at the same time and create these very musicianly moments. And I think that's often for worse, and they kind of take away what makes that artist most interesting to begin with, but that's what the Grammys do. They're really invested in this idea of musicianship and authenticity. Yep. And I think Unplugged was kind of first on that. Maybe there were shows in overseas, I don't know, but you know, even for performance shows overseas like Top of the Pops and shows like that, they were either lip-synced or they were really just recreating the hit, you know, making it sound as close to what you remember as possible. And Unplugged really carved out new territory by asking musicians to do something different, by giving in to and exploiting this notion of authenticity. And it worked.
Yes.
Whether one likes it or not, and there's plenty of reasons not to, for someone like Mariah Carey, who was thought to be, you know, maybe the term these days might be an industry plant, let's say, was dating Tommy Mottola, could obviously sing, but was thought to be very manufactured and artificial. You know, and you watch her Unplugged episode, and she has this huge group behind her. It's not like her and an acoustic guitar player. She's got backup singers and Trey Lorenz and a piano player and this and that. But it still gave you the feeling of this intimate performance where she was breaking down her songs and stripping them of all the layers of technical proficiency and electronics and all the things that were thought to be antithetical to the kind of Lomax field music aesthetic. And, you know, people love that.
2024 has been an absolutely bonkers year for pop music. It feels like every single girly in the universe, and fine, even some men, has dropped a new record. It's been a lot to process. Thank God our Patreon channel, Pop Pantheon All Access, has got you covered. Every single week, we drop a bonus episode of this show, going long on everything from Taylor's The Tortured Poets Department to Beyoncé's Cowboy Carter, Dua Lipa's Radical Optimism, Kacey Musgraves' Deeper Well, Ariana Grande's Eternal Sunshine, Billie Eilish's Hit Me Hard and Soft, Charlie XCX's Brat, and all the other big albums from this year, and all with a coterie of your favorite Pop Pantheon guests. When we're not talking new albums, we're digging through new singles on our new music speed rounds, deep diving on classic albums, recapping all the big tours, and so much more. All that, plus you'll get access to our Discord channel, input on future episodes of the show, and tons of other great perks. So sign up at the icon tier now by going to patreon.com/poppantheon or by clicking the link in the show notes of this episode. You can also now subscribe for the audio only directly in the Apple Podcasts app.
The Mariah Carey episode is less than 3 years into the history of Unplugged. And when I look at the development of the show, what's really fascinating to me is how quickly this show that was an outlier was subsumed into the major currency of the music business, which was selling records. So McCartney did the show in 91. He was the first person to release an Unplugged album, you know, and it sold very, very well. Mariah did a cover of the Jackson 5, I'll Be There. It was a number one hit. That was 92. Later in 92, Eric Clapton does The Unplugged with Layla. He wins a Grammy. Layla, got me on my knees, Layla. In 1994, Tony Bennett wins a Grammy for Unplugged. So in less than 5 years, it turns from what the hell is Unplugged to everybody wants to be on Unplugged because they're going to make millions off of it.
Well, and it also, it's the best of both worlds because it's not just a commercial enterprise, but it's prestigious.
Yeah.
And artists love, you know, the idea of associating themselves with a prestige product like Unplugged. I can play, I can sing, you know, our band are great musicians. We can do this. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we'll make a mint, we'll sell millions, and we'll get this extraordinary airplay on MTV. For free.
I'm very fascinated, and it's a topic that comes up a lot on the show, in sort of the pre-poptimism era, sort of like genre taste anxieties that existed in culture, especially at this particular moment. Again, I remember them firsthand. So I'm interested in the Mariah Carey and post-Mariah Carey incorporation of more pure pop artists like into the show. And I'm interested also in the way that Unplugged was approaching that, because obviously, as you mentioned, Mariah, biggest artist of this moment in many ways in terms of just like pure singles and record sales, and yet at the same time was seen largely incorrectly as a cipher, as a product, etc., who then very effectively, I think, in a way that really helped maybe redefine her in some people's eyes as a songwriter, as someone who didn't need to be in the studio in order to sing that way. You know, it was a way to sort of prove that, again, post Milli Vanilli, a lot of anxiety about, are the vocals actually real? Are they songwriters? Can they actually perform? Form, all of that kind of thing. And also Mariah at that time had been kept very sort of like lock and key by Tommy Mottola and had not performed live a lot, which was like a big function of the MTV Unplugged episode for her, was like people didn't understand that she could exist outside of a studio setting. So I'm curious, in the sense that the show explodes, it becomes very popular. Obviously the Nirvana episode is also happening sometime around this time. Is there a gatekeeping going on as to who they let do this and not do this? Like once the show becomes really popular and they see that like an artist like Mariah Carey, or I think even the rap examples are really interesting, because now I think a lot of us think of rap as a genre like centered around credibility and skill and all of that stuff. But in rap's inception, a lot of mainstream culture like didn't take rappers particularly seriously either. And like putting them probably in this context helped people see them through the lens of rockist ideals, which seems to be the concept here. Like if we can just make Mariah Carey songs feel like they're classic rock songs, or if we can make a rapper's music sound like it's more, you know, adjacent to the ideals of rock music, then we can appreciate it for what it really is. Is MTV gatekeeping this format? Like, are they letting any big pop star who wants to participate in it do it? Or are they then being like, oh, only specific types of artists like have the ability to come on and like perform this kind of set?
Well, once Unplugged becomes a phenomenon, it turns into just another mechanism of artist relations for MTV. Not only artist relations, you know, if you can get Bob Dylan, you're going to book him. But how do Rhett and Vixen end up on Unplugged? Not necessarily that their fans were dying to see them play those songs Unplugged, but they're important bands to the network. MTV has to maintain good relationships, not just with the bands and their managers, but their record companies. And if a band that's big on MTV says, we want to do Unplugged, it's kind of hard to say no, especially once you get around 94, 95, because a lot of the baby boomer white rock guys had already done the show and you can't really repeat it. So you had a couple of things going on at the same time. There were the legacy baby boomer acts who wanted to do it, and some of them were late to come to it. You had the bands that maybe were not quite as credible, like Rat and Vixen, or like Roxette, or even Duran Duran.
Right.
You know, Craig and I are both big Duran fans. But if you're in Duran Duran and you feel like you haven't gotten the respect that you're due for your music, and you're facing this charge, you know, since 1981 of, oh, they're a video band, what better trick than to come on and not be a video band? Even though, you know, I think we realize now that those two ideas were not completely antithetical. Right? Going Unplugged didn't mean that there was no trickery, and making a video wasn't solely about trickery, but it became a prestige thing for some artists to do and a career move for others. Because even if they didn't make an Unplugged record that would sell lots of copies, they could begin to inch towards credibility.
But I would say that there weren't a lot of artists like Mariah Carey to follow in her footsteps on Unplugged. You know, she was on a kind of a one of one. You know, I think it was a combination of MTV still having a rockist approach to their musical thinking. It's still run by white people. Mm-hmm. And so there's still very few black artists who follow in LL Cool J's footsteps. You know, putting aside even hip hop, there aren't very many R&B singers getting airplay or appearing on Unplugged.
Right.
You know, Unplugged is mostly used by older rock artists who want to connect to a younger audience, whose new music videos are no longer in heavy rotation, or who maybe don't even make good music videos. You know, they're just not up with the trends. But Rod Stewart performing with Ronnie Wood, or Jimmy Page and Robert Plant getting back together, or Springsteen or Neil Young, you know, these are really more the artists that both MTV felt put Unplugged in the best light. And I think also artists that felt comfortable performing in that format. So Mariah was an outlier.
Maybe this is a reflection of the change in MTV's audience over time. But it's interesting to think that a teenager at that time wouldn't want to be seeing, I don't know, whoever the biggest pop act of like TLC do Unplugged or something like that at that moment. You know what I mean? One would think, given the youth-oriented focus of MTV, that like focusing on boomer acts wouldn't be necessarily like the best idea for them, but maybe there was interest in the MTV audience in watching Rod Stewart. I mean, I don't know.
There was interest in the MTV audience watching Rod Stewart. I mean, Rod Stewart was a big deal back then.
Right.
You know, as far as like a TLC, I don't know if they just didn't want to put the work into it to craft an acoustic hour-long or 45-minute set.
Right.
Or if MTV kind of just sniffed at it and just said, like, you guys aren't important enough.
Right.
Or what the reasons would be for those acts being excluded from the format. Maybe the risk-reward ratio wasn't good enough.
One thing that's interesting to me, though, in the context of that question is, so Unplugged seems like it has its peak really like through the 1990s, and it continues to exist into, you know, the 2000s, but it feels like it recedes in terms of importance. I'm curious why you think that is. Like, what is it about the format that begins to lose its cultural currency as the 90s wears on? And does that have to do with the fact that MTV and pop music generally begins to center around, you know, the teen pop boom? There's Britney Spears, there's Backstreet, there's a lot of artists that, like, again, I think it would have been cool to see Backstreet Boys do Unplugged, but it feels like those kind of things don't really happen, or the network starts to see those things as separate arms of what it's doing. Like, why do you see the recession of this show into the late 90s, into the 2000s, do you think?
Well, let's first look at the peak of it. In my opinion, we haven't really touched on that much, which is grunge. Right? Arguably, Nirvana's Unplugged is the definitive Nirvana document of all their albums.
Sure.
One could argue, and visually, certainly, Kurt's vocals on the Lead Belly cover may have been like the greatest singing ever on television, if not in Nirvana's career. And even Alice in Chains, Stone Temple Pilots, Pearl Jam did a great Unplugged. It was just a perfect fit. These bands all were rock bands. They knew how to play, you know, and they all became famous pretty quickly. And so stripping down their songs and showing that they had those chops was very appealing to them. They all actually had very good relationships with MTV. MTV was instrumental in breaking those bands.
Were they all releasing Unplugged albums in conjunction? Like, did that become like a De Rigueur thing at a certain
point? Not all of them, but some of them. Certainly yeah. Nirvana did. I don't think Pearl Jam's ever came out until recently as part of another reissue or something. Mm. I just went back and watched the Alice in Chains, not a band that I'm all that fond of, but that's pretty gripping stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, Kurt's a great singer. Lane Staley was a great singer. Eddie Vedder's a great singer. So being a great singer is pretty helpful to getting over on an Unplugged.
Right.
I think once that wave transpired, I'll even put REM in the early wave of that. They did a great Unplugged.
Yes.
I think the center of music didn't really hold to a certain extent. The center of MTV's musical world kind of fell apart a little bit after Kurt's death. And then, you know, in MTV land, you know, shows have very short lifespans.
Yeah.
It's based on music videos, this kind of short attention span theater. Even Beavis and Butthead, I don't know how long it actually ran for, but it now feels longer than it was.
Mm.
The Osbournes, name a show, they all had pretty short lifespans. And so Unplugged in some ways had run its course, replaced by TRL, other vehicles for artists to promote their songs and their albums and for MTV to gain audience. You know, at a certain point, even Unplugged felt like a chore for an audience to sit down to. Who had time to sit down to watch 30 minutes of or an hour, for crying out loud, of a band play a show? That's a lot to ask for a young audience once the kind of novelty had worn off. And, you know, Unplugged was a novelty when it first started and when it peaked.
Mm. By the late 90s, the programming starts to wear out, not just as an idea in people's minds. And I was going to say what Craig said, 10 years is a much longer run than people generally had, or a show generally had at MTV. But all the baby boomer bands had done it, and the major grunge bands had all done it. So, you know, let's look at what shows we remember. Alice in Chains, Oasis, with Liam drunk in the balcony heckling Noel, who's doing all the singing. That's 96. George Michael does an Unplugged in 96. Maxwell does one in 97. You know, then, okay, now we're doing Bryan Adams. Now we're doing Alanis Morissette, which was sort of the end of the first phase, right? It's like that was when they started to feel like this isn't working for us anymore. There aren't new bands who we can put on here. And all the older bands have already done it.
Once they got McCartney and Springsteen and Dylan, and they got Plant and Page to reunite, it's almost the dilemma facing Golden Voice, the company that books Coachella.
Mm,
the reunion show is one of the reasons why Coachella became the premier music festival. You know, outside of the Smiths, I guess, and maybe Talking Heads, like, who's left to reunite?
But the thing is that what Coachella has done, which is like what you would have thought maybe Unplugged would do, was to reorient themselves around what was popping. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
I think it's a weird thing. And maybe acts like Britney Spears just like were not interested in doing that. Maybe they didn't see that as advantageous. Maybe the audience of my generation like didn't care to see Britney Spears like on a strummed guitar, like with the values of what we wanted from our MTV artists at that time was the glitz and the glam, and we wanted to see the whole production, and we just like weren't as interested. Because I mean, Unplugged was on and relevant in my MTV heyday, but I don't remember it as like appointment television in the way that like other MTV shows were for me. Like TRL, absolute appointment, you know, making the video, all of that stuff. The Real World, even Road Rules, all of that stuff were all appointment television. I remember Unplugged feeling kind of fuddy-duddy in my era, like feeling like out of touch, but I don't feel like it had to be that way. You know, it just feels like a little bit of a fumble to me that they wouldn't try to mutate the format to like actually take account for what was happening in pop. But I do think it speaks to something we've been sort of poking at the whole time, which is this genre anxiety stuff that goes on, which is like maybe MTV didn't see those acts as having the capacity to carry off an Unplugged performance. And so it sort of siphoned what was happening in the TRL universe of MTV off from what was happening in like the Unplugged era of MTV, which felt stuck in the early and mid 90s.
If you were 16 or 17 in 1999, this show that had been on the air for 10 years, it may as well have been 60 Minutes or Gunsmoke or some other corny thing,
like
Murder, She Wrote.
Like
it's this corny thing that your parents were interested in. The other aspect of the burnout that we haven't really discussed discussed is that at one point there were more than 500 versions of Unplugged around the world, because as MTV became successful and propagated around the globe, each country's MTV would have its own Unplugged. I remember somebody telling us for the book research, there was an MTV Unplugged perfume that was sold in India. I'm not sure who wants to smell.
What did that smell like? They smelled like the candles
smelled
in the
like
room.
Candles and desperation. You know, it burned itself out. Like a lot of things that are successful, its success burned itself out.
Also, there are very few examples of live music successfully being put forth on television. Mm. Has there ever been a live music television show besides Unplugged that had any real sustained success in the U.S.? Maybe
SNL?
Like, and that's two songs out of 90 minutes. That's not a show all about live music, right?
Oh, you mean like centered around live music, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, the VMAs probably was another one for a while, for a certain amount of time.
Right, but that's a variety show,
right?
You know, in a way, right? So zealots or true believers have always said, why don't we just put live music on television? Mm. Who doesn't love live music? But watching it on TV is not the same at all as going to a concert. And so the fact that it even succeeded as well as it did is in some ways a small miracle, given how just kind of boring it is to watch live music on television generally. Mm. It's hard to mic properly. It doesn't have the same cathartic experience that one goes to, or the same communal experience that one goes to live concerts for. The fact that it translated so well as long as it did is a boon to the creators of the show. And the fact that it burnt out as it did is probably no surprise.
Not just live music, but live music devoid of spectacle. I mean, which was the whole point of it. You know, you watch the Grammys, you watch the VMAs, you even watch SNL, and you're getting like explosive live performances with a lot of stuff going on. You know?
And one artist after another. You're not getting one sit-down concert from one artist.
Right.
Also, if I asked you, do you prefer to go see a Britney Spears concert in all of its glory or a stripped down Britney Spears acoustic performance?
No.
Hell no. You don't want to go see that shit.
No.
So, you know, there's that too.
Here's another reason it burned out. As someone who used to go to a lot of concerts, if you went to a show from, let's say, 95 till about 2002, didn't matter what band you went to see, there would be a 3 or 4 song acoustic set in the middle of the show.
I think that rings true today, too. I got to say, I think that still happens a lot. I mean, Taylor Swift is sitting down in the middle of the Eras Tour and plucking out a bunch of songs on the piano.
So it still happens.
Yep.
And that wears down the novelty of it, right? You know, novelty, not in the derisive sense, but something that's new, something you've never seen before. Now you're seeing it all the time. You're seeing it almost every time you go to a show.
Mm. And, you know, not to brag, but I was at the Nirvana Unplugged.
No way. Oh, my God.
And it's an intimate experience to be. I was at a couple other ones, but that's the one that was the best one. It's special. You know, you feel like you're part of some history-making musical event, not just because it's Nirvana and all the drama and sadness that's, you know, now part of that, but just to be that close to an artist who are kind of pushing the boundaries of what their comfort zone.
Mm.
In the case of Kurt, crafting a whole special set, you know, with Meat Puppets covers, which I'm sure the Kirkwood brothers now thank their lucky stars every time they go to the bank and see, you know, all the royalties from Unplugged. You know, it was a special experience, both as a participant or viewer there watching it, you know, in your living room. And, you know, that has a certain expiration date.
Like, it's a good thing you said not to brag, because otherwise someone might think that you're bragging.
Okay, I'm bragging.
Honestly, that's a good brag.
Yeah.
That's a good brag. Yeah, I don't know. I think you should brag.
I do
about
dine
that.
Out on that brag.
That's a really good one. That's a great thing to drop here 55 minutes into the conversation, I gotta say. So the thing about Unplugged is it's never actually died. Like, it continues to get brought back periodically, whether it be like Lady Gaga and Tony Bennett or 21 Pilots. What has been like the post-peak story of Unplugged over the last 25 years or so?
Well, you mentioned it. I think commercially speaking, the Gaga, Tony Bennett, you know, Tony Bennett had already been a king of Unplugged, had won a Grammy for his Unplugged album, and MTV, owned by Paramount, and, you know, has Paramount Plus, the streaming service. So when Gaga and Tony Bennett were doing these farewell shows, it got sliced and diced so many different ways. It became an Unplugged album, became a CBS television special, became a Paramount Plus special. Each song was released as music videos, which, you know, no one watches MTV anymore, and certainly they don't air music videos, but, you know, it was on YouTube, each of the clips. So I think that's, you know, maybe 21 Pilots, but, you know, who really cares? The Tony Bennett Gaga was bringing back the best values and even the best commercial aspirations of what an Unplugged set could deliver for those two artists and their relationship and their clear friendship and artistic love affair. It was a perfect way to present them.
Hey, Susan. Can I sing I've Got You Under My Skin with your husband? I have permission? Okay, good.
I've got you under my skin.
And also, like, continuing the grand tradition of pop artists seeking a certain degree of credibility. I mean, in some ways, you could see Gaga's entire Tony Bennett collaborative exercise as an incredibly important part in shoring up a faction of her audience that doesn't respect the other thing that Lady Gaga does, the more synthetic pop element of the Lady Gaga thing. It's clearly paid off dividends and making her this legacy artist that people will go see play jazz songs on the piano in Las Vegas. But again, Unplugged continues to feel like it serves somewhat of the same purpose, which is like, hey, BTS, they're not just studio creations. Lady Gaga, she's not just this like drag puppet synthetic dance pop musician. Like, they're real musicians who can sit down and do this.
There's something very adult about the Unplugged format.
Right. Which makes it kind of boring in a lot of instances, I think.
Maybe it's just because I'm a million years old, but when I look at the post-1999 episodes of Unplugged, I can count on one hand the ones that really I think were extraordinary. Gaga was one of them. Jay-Z, certainly.
Jay-Z is the one that stands
with
out
the
in
roots.
My mind. Jay-Z,
right.
And the Roots. But again, similar purpose. I feel like this was Jay-Z pivoting from hardcore street rapper to where he is now, which is like Friendly Daddy. It was a softening mechanism for him.
What we doing, y'all?
It's a great one, though, because his songs also with all the soul samples and those Kanye and Just Blaze productions like lend themselves very well to being stripped down in that way.
And not to be raucous, because I hate to be raucous, but watching, like, for instance, if you go back and watch the famous caked deodorant under the arm, yeah. LL Cool J, Mama Said Knock You Out performance. It's great.
Yes.
It is incredibly exciting to watch, not just because of the novelty of it, but, you know, the musicianship is great. The band's killing it. The whole thing has a really high energy level. And there are times where that kind of musicianly approach really does add something to the song.
Yes.
And having the Roots back your songs is no small feat. You know, they're a great band and there is something great about hearing it, you know?
Yes, absolutely. The one that we didn't talk about that really stands out to me as one of the last ones that I really remember was the Lauryn Hill one, because everyone had been hotly anticipating and still is Lauryn Hill's sophomore album. And really her sophomore album is this MTV Unplugged set where she performed a fleet of new songs
and played guitar
and that was kind of the only set of post Miseducation of Lauryn Hill music that we ever got. So I really remember that one very clearly.
It was a hot
well.
Mess, but it was very memorable.
It was a hot mess, but a memorable hot mess that I think has weird value because of its novelty and like the fact that like she never put anything else out.
Eat your brain, because it all falls down. Telling you all. Can't handle the truth in a courtroom.
I'm sure she must have been asked 1,000 times. I wonder why Madonna never did an Unplugged.
I was going to ask this, especially in that Ray of Light moment where she was playing into a lot of these tropes.
The flagship MTV artist. You would have thought that at some point she would have, taken it off.
Yeah, she would have done a great job. Honestly, Madonna should do Tiny Desk. If Tiny Desk is the inheritor, then Madonna should do Tiny
Desk.
Totally. I guess as a last question for you both, what is a moment or a performance on this show that maybe is even less sort of iconic or known to people that just stands out to you in your memory? Is there like a specific song or a particular moment on the show that just felt like a moment that really showed why this could be a great thing, why this was a great format in its heyday?
Well, when I was at the Nirvana Unplugged contest, I'll tell you one moment. This is a very boring, raucous moment, but Rod Stewart did a very good Unplugged that actually really helped resuscitate his career. And Ron Wood, his former bandmate, performed with him. And there's a great version. There's a bunch of great versions, but there's one where he's doing Mandolin Wind. And Rod Stewart's playing a banjo during it, which I had never seen before and haven't seen since. And I think for musicians, especially those older musicians, there's a kind of getting back to their roots before they were platinum artists and had all the money in the world to make records. And there's a kind of back to the rehearsal space where you're just sitting in a room and, you know, noodling around with your buddies. And Ron Wood makes fun of Rod Stewart and says something to the effect of, the scariest moment in any set is when Rod picks up an instrument. It's really worth watching. It's a great performance.
There are two moments for me. One of them is Roxette in 1993 doing Neil Young and the Byrds songs, which is just like a what the fuck moment.
Mm.
And then Soul Asylum with Lulu.
Mm.
Doing To Sir With Love, you know, which again is
that's
what I wanted to see on MTV. Stuff that just confused me and didn't make any sense and would take me years to figure out. First of all, why Soul Asylum on MTV? Same reason they were on the radio, because there wasn't much else going on. And then why is Lulu sitting in with them? I still don't really understand.
I think we should go out on that performance of Soul Asylum with Lulu, because I also hold dear to me the randomness of the MTV ethos. Like back in the heyday of MTV, that sort of feeling of like, what the fuck is happening was such a fun thing to draw you into this network and its whole culture. So I think that's a perfect song for us to end this discussion on. Rob Tannenbaum, Craig Marks, I cannot thank you guys enough for doing this.
Thank you, Louie. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.